The first question I wanted to ask you is, what was your kind of first experience with homelessness?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't really remember, like, first conscious memory of homelessness. Well, I mean, my family's from Lower Mainland. My mother's from Bowen Island, my dad's from Langley. And both of them, you know, in their late teens and early 20s, moved into the city and hung out with family and stuff here. Mm-hmm. So my grandma lived in Vancouver when I was a kid. And when I would come to visit her, we would go down to Woodward's, down on Hastings Street on the weekends, and sort of aware that as I got older that there were, and the area really was sort of rapidly deteriorating, and there were more, I mean, always was Skid Row, like always a lower income neighborhood for sure, but that there were people who appeared to be living on the street, which, you know, when you're a kid, sort of you're like, that's weird, right? And talking to her about it, and then, yeah, and drugs and all the other stuff that comes along with Skid Row. So, yeah, is that, I don't know if that maybe, answers your question.
Well, Councilman Jenks said that at one point you were a street kid, mm-hmm. and that gave you an interesting perspective. So I was hoping maybe you would want to talk about that and how that kind of came about and your experiences there.
Sure, I'll give you the sort of highlights. How about that? The highlights of homelessness. It's a complicated story, but essentially sort of decided it would be easier to go and find my own way in the world when I was the later stage of being 13, early 14. And, you know, sort of had places on and off, but essentially was, it's very hard to have a viable income when you're that age. So never really figured out how to sort of keep home for any length of time. So sort of drifting around with a group of people that shifted, but all of whom, each group could probably be characterized as being homeless, and living with them homeless, sometimes with home. It's never so simple, right? Mm. Like, it's, there are people, like, I was just doing a homeless count the other day in the morning, and there was a guy there who's, like, homeless, right? He has no desire to sleep inside, doesn't want to work, is happy with the way he is, so maybe that's at one sort of edge of the spectrum. And then at the other edge of the spectrum, you have people who actually have pay for housing, but it's so unsafe. And we actually talk to people like this during the homeless camp, that they don't sleep in it at night, which seems odd, right? Like, you think, well, why would someone pay rent and then not stay there? And yet then you have to think, well, how bad must it be if they're blowing $300, $400, $500 a month on it, and they just don't feel safe enough to, they feel safer sleeping outside than they do inside, right? So I would say that I never hit the spectrum of actively desiring to sleep outside every, like, that wasn't my interest, but definitely had times where I was paying rent and it was too unsafe inside to, in wherever that was, to stay there, and other times where, you know, it's so much easier on the streets to just keep moving, because then you're, like, to keep, not moving houses, but just keep moving cities, right, or even countries or continents, because it's way cheaper than staying in one place and sort of racking up costs and debts and all those other things that come with that, so, yeah.
All right, and how did you then kind of get out of that?
Well, it's a pretty long process, right, and not very linear, like, it didn't sort of start here and end there. Sorry, I know you're taping, so you can't actually see my hand moving across that graph, but, it, you know, it's kind of a meandering path, but essentially what it came down to, I mean, I never had any aspiration to be homeless or live on the streets, but at the same time, I felt that compared to the choice of being inside and the available options at times, this was a better option. But it did come down to sort of realizing that the people around me were either dying or, and because there's a lot of drug, like, in alcohol abuse and other sorts of, a lot of mental illness and violent behavior and just weird shit too, right? A friend of mine got killed. Her, she was hitchhiking, and her friend got hit by someone, and an ambulance was called, you know, way out on this highway, and as the ambulance was pulling up, it hit her and killed her, right? Her friend survived. So just, I mean, it's just so bizarre, right? Like, when does that ever really happen in life, right? another friend, we used to go swimming in a quarry all the time. He jumped, I mean, we probably jumped into that quarry 1,000 times, and he jumped not like foot first and managed to twist as he was going down and whack his head and was killed that way, right? So, I don't know, like, just weird shit happens. So you sort of think, well, so they either ended up dead, or a lot of them ended up as born-again Christians, because a lot of the social services are actually private services provided by charities, which tend to be Christian charities. So you're really vulnerable, and you end up in this space, and these people tell you if you believe in something, maybe your life will get better, so that happens. And then the other path was sort of just chronic fuck-ups, right? Like they didn't die, and they weren't Christians, but you just sort of, like, they were 40, 45, 50 years old, and they were... they seem to have no real fulfillment or direction in life. So since I really didn't see any sort of pathway forward to either of those three states, that whatever, I was like, this is great, you know? Just sort of wanted to find ways to see a future that was a better future than that. And I also realized, like, I used to do a lot of panhandling, or, you know, you're traveling and you're hitchhiking, you talk to people who are normal. I sort of realize over time nobody's actually normal, but at the time they seem more normal than I was. And realizing that as time was going on, I understood this normal world less and less. Like, just being able to talk to people and communicate with them was getting harder and harder. The kind of things they were thinking about and the kinds of things I was thinking about were just so different. And so then you start worrying about ever being able to kind of reintegrate into the normal world, right? So I actively looked for, at that time it was like the late 80s, early 90s, there was like a ton of government programs compared to now. Mm-hmm. It felt like not a lot back then, but there was a ton of government programs to help you get off drugs, off the streets, off whatever, right? In my case, I found one that did employment skills and went and enrolled in that and found something that I liked way better than not doing something. So, yeah.
Let's skip ahead a bit then, and I'll come back to the housing issue in a second, but what made you run for council? What influenced you to run for council?
Wow, that's a long story too. Sorry, I should have a shorter story on it. I could give you a message box, but you probably actually want to know, like, why, right?
Well, we're looking for kind of narratives, the kind of story behind
sure.
it.
So. Well, you know, I have always been quite politically active. My own belief is that, I mean, I'm not really young anymore, but tend to be on the younger side of the political kind of elected official zone, and I get totally pissed off when everyone says young people aren't active, blah blah blah, because they might not be involved in formal politics and voting, but they're, in my opinion, extremely involved in issues and trying to change policy. They go to rallies and meetings and sign petitions and talk to their friends a lot about things they want to see changed about the world and how much things bug them. They get on Facebook. You know, like, there's a lot of things happening. It's just not necessarily running for office. So when I was, like, as young as 10, 11, I was, you know, actively involved in going to rallies to stop apartheid in South Africa and trying to stop the famine in Ethiopia, which was caused by a civil war, and, you know, stuff like that, right? And by the time I was 18, I'd rallied, meeting, petitioned, sat in, stood in, you name it, right, to try and change policies around welfare, around the environment, around student loans, around transportation, around housing, and was really excited about being able to vote in my first election, because obviously if you could change the idiots making the decisions, maybe you wouldn't have to do all these things anymore, right? It wasn't that self-interested, but you get my point, right? A better government would mean a lot less community organizing time that you'd have to invest. And the world might change. But really amazingly, I was by far the youngest of the people that I was working with on all these issues. They're like, why would you vote? Like, that's just total waste of time, right? And it was really amazing to me. Like, none of them had voted in a long time. None of the people my age had, like, any interest. They're like, you're so wacky, right, for wanting to get involved. And really, from that, sort of started on this path. Of course, I voted, and the person I vote for didn't win, so then got, you know, instead of getting turned off by that, I actually got a lot more turned on into trying to figure out why this whole, to me, democracy is a very, I've lived in countries and visited countries where they don't have democracy. It's quite a sacred thing to me, like a really important piece of, it's it's a big gift that we got from a lot of people who suffered a lot to give it to us, right? And I know it sounds corny, but when you live in a country where people don't have those rights, it's pretty, and are struggling to get the right to vote or the right to choose who's going to govern them, it's serious shit, right? Like, they take it pretty seriously, and so they should. So, anyway, all to say that I got involved in, you know, political party, well, in electoral reform, and then in a political party, even though I swore I'd never get involved in a political party, and then over time, you've asked so many people to run for that party that you have to run yourself if you want to have any credibility. And then I got elected to school board, and then when you're a woman and you're younger, suddenly everybody wants you to run for them, right? Because young women are very, there's not a lot of them that are interested in running for public office or electable because their resumes aren't there yet. So anyway, that's, it's a long process, right? And I remain a little bit skeptical, I don't know, I don't know that it's skeptical. It's hard to know whether you make more change from being on the outside pushing on the inside or from the inside pushing on the outside, right? Mm. So that's the, the way it's supposed to work is that civil society, all these nonprofits and unions and business organizations and all of that, and citizens, they're supposed to push to make room. It's like plowing a field so that the elected officials can walk in and plant seeds and good things grow, right? That's the theory behind all of this. And generally it does work well that way. The problem is we don't really use the system that way, right? So, long story, I know. Specific things that I wanted to do now on council, definitely on the environmental issues, like really... I worked in environmental activism for a long time and volunteered in that, and so I have this sort of, you know, I'm probably in the 1% of Canadians that have read tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of pages of scientific reports that just scare the living bejesus out of you, right? Because we're not on a good...
Yeah.
That graph is actually pretty straight, and it always points down, right, in terms of environmental... every indicator we have, from toxic pollution to climate change to biodiversity to species loss, is really not good, like really terrifying territory. So the response to that needs to be pretty big, right? And Gregor Robertson, the mayor of Vancouver, had obviously really, really, really committed to seeing big change, right? So it seemed to make it worthwhile to take a job that... I had a job that I really loved before this, so now I'm doing a job that has... anywhere between 18 to 20 hours a day of work and very little thanks and a lot of crap, right? Like you subject yourself to a lot of bullshit. And yeah, it was worth it to make that change happen. Yeah.
Very good. Sorry, excuse me.
That's okay. Sorry, I'm not giving you the best
airlines.
My blood sugar is just getting back up to normal. We don't eat a lot either, which is another problem with this job. When you're eating breakfast at 3 in the afternoon, you know there's issues.
Do you want to talk maybe a little bit about the, let's start with the history of the politics of social housing?
That's a big, long history. And, you know, I don't want to misrepresent, like, the green issue really was, for me, what made it worthwhile for me personally to, like, it's a piece that didn't exist on the team other than in the mayor's office, and the mayor is the mayor, so he only has so much time to push on stuff. But having a mayor who's as committed as Gregor is to ending homelessness is pretty amazing as well. So it's a very compelling reason to get involved. Social housing, wow. well, depending on how you look at it, I mean, there is a case to be made that we've had social housing for the last 5,000 years of human civilization, if not longer, right? But like all these monarchies and emperors and divine rulers owned 100% of the land, and they gave, if you had housing, it was because someone had given it to you, right? Like, so the idea that you don't actually have a birthright on the planet, like that you, by virtue of you being born, you don't actually have the right to occupy a piece of land or a house or something, is a very, very, very old concept in human history. We had, I was just talking to my daughter about this last night, thanks to the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment and all that, this idea that we actually all were created equal, and thus naturally flowing out of that was the idea that we therefore must all have the same right to occupy a piece of land, right? The other problem, though, is that the Age of Reason... So there was sort of this renaissance in the 17, 1800s that led to land reforms, where land was taken away from large landowners and given to people for them to own, right? And that was a problem. Well, that was a problem that people didn't own land, they were given land and they were owned it, but as soon as they got to own it, of course you want to own more of it, because maybe the next guy isn't as nice and he starts to want to take your land. So you sort of get this instinct to kind of, you know, create a little estate of your own, right? And that's what's led us eventually to this path, interestingly. So the opening up of our thinking and our compassion actually has led to a closing down of our thinking and compassion around land ownership and housing access. So in the more modern times, like by the 1900s, the sort of apex of unregulated capitalism in the North American and the European context as well, you again saw these land barons, right? Like suddenly they'd gone from being monarchs, lords, ladies, whatever, to being people who just amassed enough wealth and were smart. You played Monopoly. Yeah. You win by trying to get as much property as humanly, even if you have to go into debt to get the property. It's way better off than going into debt to pay rent for someone else owning that property, right? So in the 1900s, thankfully, we you know, might not have totally solved the land question, but we had, because of the Age of Enlightenment, solved some of these democracy issues. Voters started to say to governments, this is nuts, this game of monopoly isn't working for those of us who rent, so figure out a way to make this happen. So all through the 1900s, especially after the war, like 1950s, 60s, you saw this fairly massive investment in social housing, so public, you know, essentially taking money from landowners through taxation and redistributing it to renters through the provision of social housing to those, because housing is by far your single largest chunk of expense each month, to try and bring down rent so that people who were renters would pay less for rent. They wouldn't enrich someone else by doing it, and hopefully through that could get to the point where they could, you know, stabilize their finances to get an education, to have access to transportation and better food and all these things that make quality of life higher in Canada or the United States, right? Then in the 80s and 90s, you saw that all that tide totally went out again, in part because the redistribution of wealth concept wasn't working well for the people who previously had been wealthy. So, you know, they also exercised the vote and they made a choice to organize well enough to start the tide moving away from that. So in Canada, mid-1990s is when we saw the big, like the bottom fallout of investment in social housing. And as a result of that, 2010, so it's like a good 15, 20 years since we've had any new social or even purpose-built rental, which was supported by government subsidies. We haven't seen any of it built, so now we have a housing crisis. We're below 2% vacancy in Vancouver and massive failure at every possible piece of the housing spectrum other than condos. We got a lot of condos. If you want a condo and you can afford one, we've got condos for you. Everything else we have very little of. So what happens is people that, I'm 38, I've got a kid who's 13. My husband's a wildlife biologist, got a master's degree. I don't actually have a university education, but, you know, let's say I did for the sake of argument. We're exactly the demographic that should own our own home. By now, we should own our own little home and or, you know, apartment, whatever. And if we did that, we wouldn't live in the house we live in, which really someone like you should live in, right? Like but it is for a particular age group,
yeah, no,
right?
Absolutely.
So because I'm in your housing, you then go into some even lower income housing and remove probably a single white guy who otherwise would have been in it. So he moves into a single residency accommodation downtown and displaces another probably older single white guy who was living there, and then that person ends up out on the street, right? So because there's not housing along all of these pieces, that's how you see the bottom fall out.
So do you want to talk about
short history of social
the kind of
or?
Current political landscape around around kind of nationally, I guess, but also locally around homelessness and what that's like?
There's lots of logic and rationale and huge reports written with tons of data that explain all of the financial case behind it, all of the social problems that are associated with a lack of investment in housing, the economic case, so like how the economy is falling apart, like when people don't have safe, secure housing, they start to be much less productive workers, as you can imagine, right? And they start having to move further and further out, which means they have to commute further and further in, and, you know, there's all sorts of problems associated. Ultimately, though, most human decisions get made because of emotions and how people feel about it. And what's really changed, I mean, all of these logic cases existed the day all these programs were cut. There's never been a lack of logic supporting governments investing in housing for people. And there's financial, I could go on. There's lots of logic, but it is how people are feeling about things. And in the 90s, we were coming out of recession. People felt like, why should I have to suffer even a little bit more so that this other person doesn't have to suffer, right? Like that was sort of the feelings people had around it. I think we finally got into a place, thankfully, because we have leaders, people in that, people who look like those other people, those people who go, well, why should I have to suffer, saying, actually, I am willing to pay more taxes to make sure that people in my community aren't suffering at the level they're suffering on the streets. So I think we're finally at a place where people are feeling like they should be doing something about homelessness, and that's what's going to make things change. I know that sounds airy-fairy and fuzzy, but it is actually, it's the biggest motivator. Before we got to this phase, the phase right before this was guilt. People felt like they should do something, but then kind of went, well, why haven't we? And guilt is a terrible motivator, right? Like, people just turtle up and kind of run away from the issue. And there's still many people you come across in the community who do feel guilty and angry about what's happened on homelessness, and together, guilt and anger combine to inaction. Yeah. So we've gotten to the feeling compassionate, feeling empowered, feeling like change is possible, seeing change happening. And now we have to convince people, unfortunately, all across the country, because it should be a federal issue, and a lot of them haven't quite got to that feeling place yet.
That was going to be my next question. I should ask, kind of like, who are the kind of current stakeholders in the housing issue and the social housing issue, and why aren't the feds one of them?
You know, in this city, we're housing, like, we're at a 2% vacancy rate in the middle of the largest recession that the world, not just BC, but the entire world has seen in over 80 years, right? So you sort of go, well, like, if this is what Ghost Town looks like, is a 2% vacancy rate, like, we're going to be at, like, 0.01 again, which is insane. Like, it's totally nuts. If you have a 0.1 vacancy rate, which we did hit in the height of the economic boom, your economy comes to a crashing halt because there's no service workers anymore, or you're paying them, like, $20 an hour to try and, you know, so that they can flip burgers. Not that I'm against paying them $20 an hour, but then you have to pay everybody else more money because they have mortgages and all these other things that they have to service, right? So your economy goes through some pretty rapid shocks if your housing is in that low supply, because the demand will drive price way, way, way up, right? So in this city, there's no one who's not a stakeholder. Everybody is affected through the things that they buy. The crowds of homeless people, they have to, like, pick their way over to get, you know, anywhere, really, and in almost any part of the city, because that's what massive housing failure looks like, right? And employment, I went through some of the arguments earlier, but, you know, you and I are paying $7 billion for a new massive highway expansion so that more people, instead of building housing in the city, we've let the private market build housing way the heck out there. So now you and I are paying for a $7 billion highway so those people can get back into the city faster during the day to go to school and to go to work, right? Like, there's no logic to any of this, and yet it happens, right? Provincial government has decided, under the law, the provincial government should be the main stakeholder, just the way the Constitution is written in Canada. However, experience has shown that in countries that have dealt with this successfully, because there is such regional disparity, right? Saskatchewan's a very different province than Newfoundland, than British Columbia, than Quebec, right? That we need a federal, like a national housing program that ensures that there's a minimum. Like, we have a National Health Act that says this is the minimum that can exist in each province. We need a National Housing Act that says the same thing, and also takes, of every tax dollar that leaves Vancouver, 52 cents of it goes to Ottawa. we're just asking for a little bit of it back so that we can deal with the problems we have here in British Columbia.
And so the feds are, but the feds are not conducive to this, as I understand it.
The feds is a big institution, right? So of the 308, 314, whatever number of MPs we have right now, the minority of them belong to a party that's not that interested in this discussing. The majority of them belong to parties that say or have demonstrated a strong interest in this discussion. So that goes back to why I got involved in politics, that democracy problem. It is like about keeping attention high enough on the fact that we have the majority of votes in the House of Commons to support a National Housing Act, so let's just go through with the vote. And I know the Conservatives are the government, but they don't actually control a majority of votes in the House, so there's nothing to say that we couldn't have a vote on housing.
All right.
So it's a good time, actually. Like, a majority government would be a much harder
juggernaut
to kind of... Yeah, and if you look at majority vote, I mean, we haven't had a majority government with a majority vote of Canadians in a very long time. So I think it's like 1968 or something is the last time a government won a majority of seats because a majority of people voted for them, right? Yeah. So now is a good time because we have a minority government that more closely reflects the actual support they have across the country, which is not even half of Canadians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So why not let the other 60-some-odd percent vote right now on putting an investment in housing?
All right. We are kind of looking for kind of stories, because we have a very kind of narrative focus on what we're looking at. So I normally ask just kind of an open question. Is there any kind of experience that particularly sticks out around the issue of housing and homelessness that you might want to share, like any kind of story you have?
Sorry, give me one sec. I'm meeting with a union guy. I'm like,
that's okay, but should they start?
Yeah, they can start. I'll be like 2 minutes. I apologize. Okay, see you in a minute. Firefighters. A story that kind of sticks out. I guess the piece about it that I would really love to challenge people on, or challenge them to think about, we have had... Have you ever heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this idea? Yeah, okay, so first you need to be safe, and then once you're safe, you need a security of person, and once that, then you need some food and shelter, and then at some point... you get to the other needs, right? You have a need to learn, you have a need for democracy, a need for creativity, all these needs. So our whole idea about solving homelessness in Western society in Canada, we've been fighting like dogs just to get the money to provide people with those first three levels of that hierarchy of needs, and to give it to them. My own experience of getting off the streets is that people could get off all by themselves if we build the housing, and if we have programs that support the philosophy, right? So if you look at the world as a hierarchy of needs, I think you're kind of missing the boat. There's another model called Max Neves' fundamental needs. He says we have an equal need for democracy, compassion, liberty, all of these things, food, shelter, security. So if we could design programs that allow people to exercise their creativity, their democracy, their liberty, their compassion, all of these things, and provide housing, basically an empowerment model, right? So to give you like the story behind that, imagine that when you're on the streets, you line up all day. That's all you do. You wake up from wherever you are and you get in a lineup right away to go get a coffee or a hot chocolate or maybe some food if you're really lucky. And then you get out of that lineup to go in another lineup to maybe get access to a shower or dryer or something, right? A bathroom, maybe you get in that lineup. And the crazy thing about these lineups, you don't even know if when you get to the end of the line that there'll be someone to give you something, right? Like, or that there'll be something left for them to give you. Then you get in another lineup for lunch, and then in the afternoon you probably get in another lineup at another place to go to the bathroom, and then finally you get in your lineup for dinner, and then you might get in a lineup later in the evening for another coffee, and then you might get in the lineup for a shelter, or you go find a place to sleep, and the whole thing starts all over again the next day. So you imagine taking that person and putting them into a house and saying, do whatever you want, right? It's not a system that works. But imagine taking that same person and saying, here is a space, right? And there's food in the space, there's a blanket, stack of blankets. You get into a shelter. Take whatever blanket you want, right? Take whatever cot you want. Take whatever, like, make your own decisions about, and have the people that are staying in the shelter that night come up with the ground rules about how it's going to work that night and have discussions about that. That person is going to self be able to develop the skills to get off the streets a lot faster than the person who's constantly in these, like, incredibly depressing, demeaning, degrading, and just dehumanizing lineups all day, every day, right? So it's not just about spending the money, it's about us kind of flip. I actually believe the reason we do this, the reason we kind of make people go through all these lineups, is because we're trying to meet our own need for compassion, right? We're trying to be kind of show our compassion to them, but what about if we let them show their compassion to us, right? Like, what would that look like, and how would that change this whole situation? Anyway, that's not really a story. But it is a good narrative around how we could change the narrative on homelessness. And my own experience, I got off because someone trusted that I could, right? Like, that's just really different than someone handing me a bunch of things that eventually cumulatively said, okay, well, now she's safe, secure, she's fed, and she has shelter, so she's going to get off the streets, right?
Right.